Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Angela King was a neo-Nazi in her home state of Florida for 8 years. After the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, she started to question how far she was willing to go for her white supremacist beliefs. She tried to leave the group but failed, and in 1998 she was convicted of a hate crime and spent 3 years in a federal prison. And that is where her life absolutely changed. Angela joins us on the line now. Angela, how are you?
I'm well today, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
To bring it back to the beginning, your family were quite conservative, and you were sent to kind of expensive schools, really, when you were growing up, weren't you?
Yes. You know, honestly, as a child, when I heard racial slurs or stereotypes or homophobic comments, it seemed normal to me because I didn't know anything different. And going into, school, I was bullied, internalized a lot of negativity, and my life just started to spin out of control.
Did you have an inkling about your sexuality, and do you think that might be where some of your anger stemmed from?
I did, actually. I need to kind of qualify the feelings I had about it, though. I was raised where there was a lot of organized religion. My father was Baptist, my mother was Catholic, so I went to Baptist private school during the day, plus attended, Catholic services and got my communion. I had the idea and the feeling of being attracted to the same sex, but I didn't have a name for it. I didn't know what it was called, but one thing I was very clear on is that there was something wrong with me. I couldn't let my family find out. At such an early age, I literally had visions of being stoned or excommunicated from my family or burning in fiery pits of hell. And that was a lot to process as
right.
an adolescent.
That's a lot to have on board, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you were in school, there was this incident where you were being bullied, basically. Somebody ripped open your shirt. That you reckon that was very... formative for you, that experience?
Oh, goodness. There are a lot of things that I could call that experience. But essentially, I had been bullied for a few years, but it had been verbal. I had been spit at once, but nothing physical until that point. And there I was in my, training bra. I was pudgy. I've always struggled with my weight from the time I was a child. And to have that happen and have my shirt ripped open in front of the entire class, in addition to all the students who were then pouring into the classroom because they knew there was a fight, even today at the age of 42, I feel the humiliation and feel my face burn, red, even talking about that.
Wow. They say you'll forget a beating, but you'll never forget a humiliation.
Nope.
Right.
Not at all.
Reacted though to that, and that was a moment where you fought back.
It was, as a child, there were a few things that I heard from my parents growing up, and one of those things was, that I was never to go out and put my hands on someone to start a fight. But if anyone started a fight with me, if I didn't fight back. And win the fight, I was going to get it worse when I got home.
Yeah.
So when I was bullied, when my shirt was ripped open, there was that intense level of humiliation. I literally felt like I wanted the floor to open up and just suck me down and, that be the end of it. But it was one of those moments where things seemed to go in slow motion. And there was this rage that just floated out of me in a way that scared me. I didn't expect it. I didn't really have the intellectual or capacity or was mature enough to understand what it was. And honestly, that day fighting back, it wasn't a case of, yay, somebody finally stood up to the bully. I became the bully that day because
right.
I reasoned with myself, if I do this kind of stuff to other people, this can never happen to me again.
Right. So is this when you start kind of hanging around with punks who are very much into neo-Nazism?
Not quite yet. After that incident, I became the school bully. Then I became the neighborhood bully. And then once I got to high school, I became the bully there as well. So I would say it was shortly into me beginning high school that I met this group of punk rock kids. There was no racism attached to it, neo-Nazi beliefs. It was, you know, the safety pins, the anarchy symbols, the ripped clothing, that kind of stuff. And I went around in high school. I'm sure we all remember what those days were like. You know, you find a group to fit into and it becomes like, you know, your group and your people. I had a very hard time finding that kind of acceptance. And I looked for it in numerous places. Honestly, I hung out with the kids that skipped school and smoked, you know, marijuana. I started hanging out with a gang and I ended up getting raped. And by the time that happened, there was so much more anger and rage just pouring out of me.
I would say so.
Then I came back around to the punk rock group. And at that time, they were then neo-Nazi skinheads.
Right.
So the anarchy symbol was replaced with a swastika and Confederate flags. And it really began there.
And you're full of anger and hatred. Who's the anger really directed at?
Oh, you know, I wouldn't have been able to answer this then. It's only in retrospect, after a few decades of, doing a lot of very deep introspection. A lot of it was aimed at myself because I hated myself. I internalized, you know, when I was bullied and called names, I internalized everything I was told. When I was told I was ugly, I believed I was ugly. When I was told that I was a freak, I believed I was a freak. Any of those things. And it was literally at that point and age where you're trying to, you know, define yourself, who you are. You're trying to learn about what's expected of you in the world, how to navigate the world around you. And it really set me off immediately on a very self-destructive path.
Right. To bring it to where this self-destruction and destruction kind of goes, you do join path with a kind of white extremist group. You're starting to get to a point where these are quite violent people, aren't they?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Saying stuff to you that it was Jews that owned the slave ships and they were the ones who'd brought black people to America and they had done that to endanger the white race.
Yes, that was part of the quote-unquote conspiracy that we were taught.
How much were you buying into all that?
You know, initially, even though I was raised with racism and homophobia and that kind of stuff, I didn't join them because there was some, you know, kind of connection with the belief. Initially, it was because they accepted me. I never had to explain why I was angry, violent, why any of those things happened. But what happens in those kind of groups is a person goes, you know, trying to fill some kind of void or something in their lives. And once they're there, the hooks go in, the indoctrination begins. And once that started to happen with me, it gave me an excuse for everything that was going wrong in my life.
Right.
I literally was, you know, taught there is this conspiracy, you know, the best thing you can ever do as a white woman is to propagate and, you know, have, you know, a place in carrying on your race and, you know, always be aware of and well-versed about these conspiracies against us. And, it, you know, looking back, it sounds ridiculous today.
Right,
that I would think, oh, yeah, Jewish people orchestrated this entire thing where they stole people from one continent and brought them to another. You know, it doesn't make sense today, but as, you know, an angry young woman who was bullied, who was vulnerable, who was looking for a place to fit in and belong and to be accepted, it made perfect sense to me then.
Right. Just tell me a little bit about your actions. I mean, were you behaving violently towards, you know, gay people or colored people? Were you involved in attacks towards them?
To be very honest, I was engaged in more violence toward other white people than any other marginalized group. Okay. I was, as a woman, called on to handle internal issues. For instance, you know, if a leader, a man, you know, that was the leader of a group said, hey, we have a problem with this woman over here, and, you know, we don't want to inflict violence, can you go take care of it? I would, because I thought, oh my, you know, I'm important. They count on me. They need me to do things. And it, you know, the best way to really summarize it is I dehumanized myself to such a point that it made it okay for me to do the same thing to others.
Okay. What was it led you to going to prison?
I went out one night with a group of, you know, fellow violent far-right extremists, all skinheads. We went to a bar where they served underage people because not everyone in the group was old enough to drink. We drank a lot. We got into a huge fight in the bar. We left before the police came, and we drove around intoxicated and very high off the adrenaline from that fight. And we started talking about, you know, our beliefs and what was within our power to further our cause. What we could we do with, you know, ourselves to promote the organization we were a part of. So we decided, you know, there are certain groups of people that we're told they're okay to hurt because they're not white or they're not like us.
Yeah.
So let's go rob them and take the money and send it to our organization. So imagine, you know, a car full of five intoxicated, mostly skinheads driving around looking for a place to rob that we felt would be a perfect kind of target for us. I sat in the car. I helped in the planning of it. When we did settle on a place, one of the males went in and robbed the store. I never spoke up. I never said, hey, let's think about this. We could, you know, seriously hurt someone. Someone could lose their life. I was, you know, actively a part of the planning, and I did nothing to stop it. And that's what led me to prison.
Okay. Going into prison, you're heading in as a neo-Nazi, and you have visible tattoos, don't you, on your body of your beliefs?
Yes, absolutely. I had swastikas, you know, different runes and symbols that were indicative of the groups I belonged in and
right.
the beliefs I had.
Yeah, the SS so, lightning thing you had.
Yes, right. I had, you know, this kind of shield tattoo on one of my fingers that had, you know, in one small shield was a swastika, and another one were the SS bulls, and in another one was a Triskelion. And I had the year 93 from when, you know, that was the year I got it tattooed on my finger. So, yes, absolutely. I went into this prison covered in racist tattoos that, you know, I could not cover them all.
Right. So I presume you're expecting the worst as you go in. But what actually happens when you get inside?
What actually happened was nothing that I expected. I was initially put into solitary confinement, which is called the special housing unit. I spent 3 or 4 weeks in there because they, you know, honestly didn't know if I was going to go into the prison and start a race riot or if people were going to, you know, come after me. But once I was put into the general population, I thought to myself, you know, my case is a highly publicized hate crime. We still get news and newspapers in the prison. Everyone knows I'm a skinhead. I can't hide all my tattoos. I thought I would be spending whatever time I was going to have in prison with my back against the wall defending myself.
Right.
That's not what actually happened, though.
No, go on. Tell us what happened.
It's going to sound like a very simple thing, but I used to smoke cigarettes back then, and smoking was allowed in the prison. There was this little caged-in rec area where women would, you know, there was a basketball hoop. It was the smoking area. So women would sit out there and smoke. They would play games. And I was sitting out there by myself one day smoking a cigarette, and this woman of color said, hey, do you know how to play cribbage? And I have always had a potty mouth, so I'm not going to give you, you know, my direct answer. But yeah, pretty much it was, what the heck is cribbage? And she was a Jamaican woman. And she literally brought the little cribbage board over and taught me how to play. And I started having experiences like that that really made me question myself. You know, I thought, this is not what I was taught. This is not what I was told. These people are treating me like a human being, even though they know I'm in here for a hate crime. And literally, there wasn't one single defining moment that changed it all. There were several different catalysts and realizations that happened while I was in prison.
One of the big ones is that you fall in love, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Now, tell me, and you fall in love with somebody that if you'd met when you weren't in prison, you might have attacked.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I know it sounds odd. It was odd for me as well. But when I was in prison and when I was learning how to become a human being again, it was honestly the freest I had felt in my entire life. And I know that doesn't make sense, saying I felt free in a prison. But when these other women, you know, treated me like a human being, I did start to see myself that way again. And I did start to see, you know, possibilities in a future, because I never even expected to make it to the age I am now. I'm 42. Obviously, not all the women embraced me or were nice to me. This particular woman was also Jamaican, and she hated my guts. She would, you know, stare me down. She would make rude comments to me. And usually, you know, I was defensive and aggressive back and would, you know, just not say kind things in return or take her seriously. And one day, I was walking past, and she made some comment to the effect of, how does a person even get to be like you? It wasn't those exact words, but it was something similar. And I don't know what it was, but something inside me just felt like I could answer honestly without being defensive. And I told her, I was raised to believe this way. I've never met or actually spoken to people of color before here. I don't have, you know, I don't have anything as a landing point or a foundation other than what I was taught. And we started to talk after that. And she still was like, I don't know what's wrong with you. Like, how could you do that stuff? But then she started to tell me about herself too. And she had been involved in some very violent gangs. And as we talked about ourselves, we started to realize that we had a lot more in common than not.
Wow.
And that turned into love.
Right. Love with someone that you could never 10 years previously have imagined such a thing. You have to wonder, you know, the challenge to, you know, your previous belief systems is so profound. It really does show that your previous beliefs were so prejudiced. It almost beggars belief. When you came out, you formed Life After Hate, which is trying to help other people, isn't it, who are in white supremacist groups to try and get out of it, which isn't that easy. But the current administration, the Trump administration, has cut the funding, hasn't it?
Yes, and actually I spent a decade speaking and doing outreach upon my release from prison. I was released in 2001. You know, for an entire decade, thought I was out there by myself. I was, you know, the only former racist or however I defined myself then. In 2011, I actually attended a conference there in Dublin. Uh-huh. And it brought together a bunch of us that were all former extremists. And the conference itself brought individuals who are from different backgrounds and from around the world, different types of violent extremist movements. But those of us from the far right, we were very inspired by, you know, what we took part in there, It wasn't just former extremists, it was survivors of extremist violence at this conference as well. And I know it sounds kind of, you know, like something from a movie that couldn't possibly be real, but we were in this beautiful hotel in Dublin in the middle of this courtyard that had plants and was just a very, I don't know, it looked like a scene from a movie. And we stood out there on the last day, this handful of us, and we said, you know, a few of us have been talking, speaking, doing outreach for, you know, X amount of time. Can you imagine what would happen if we all did this together? And we came home and a group of us founded Life After Hate as a nonprofit. It was already an online journal that had been started by another former member from the violent far right. So we turned it into a nonprofit, and we've been running for about 6 years now.
Right.
We've gone through some growing pains. You know, our strategies have changed as we have learned how to navigate work in countering violent extremism. So today we do a lot of things.
Okay.
We have a program called Exit USA, where we help individuals who need intervention or who request help in disengaging from the violent far right. We run a support group for individuals who have successfully disengaged.
Okay. Disengagement sounds very difficult. I presume you watched the Charlottesville events recently. A thing that really struck me was the absolute certainty in the faces of many of the extreme right people. A certainty you would have had yourself at one point, and which in your life has now been revealed to be an untruth. What did you make of it all?
Oh, to be honest, what I have personally witnessed happening here in the U.S. is exactly what I was trying to make happen decades ago when I was involved in the violent far right. I believe that the violent far right has been emboldened here by our administration. I had to brace myself before Charlottesville because I expected violence.
Right.
I was fairly certain that it was going to end in mass violence. And it was hard to deal with because that brings up feelings of guilt and shame, but it also inspires, you know, how can we help that community? How can we educate? And you are absolutely right. The people that we saw marching through that town with torches and, you know, chants about, you know, them being replaced by Jewish people.
Yeah.
It does transport me back to those days when I thought, I'm going to be like this forever. This is a truth that I know that I'm never going to part from.
Right.
And sadly, looking at these people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly, it's a truth that just doesn't seem to be going away. And as you said, people are being emboldened by the current administration, which is terrible. But Angela, I'm afraid we're beaten by the clock. It's an absolutely fascinating story. And thank you very much for joining us today. Angela King, co-founder and deputy director of Life After Hate.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas